Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we heard in the top of the hour news, President Trump officially kicking off his 2020 reelection campaign with a rally tonight in Florida. In reality, though, we all know he has been running for a second term ever since he took office. The former reality TV star, real estate mogul, the first president without prior political or military experience, has used an unorthodox style to become president and to engage in the presidency at the White House. This hour, we want to ask, how does Donald Trump compare to the 44 U.S. presidents who came before him? Why do we evaluate past presidents? How do we evaluate past presidents? What we're going to look into this hour with Tim Walch. He's Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch. Tim, welcome back to our program.
Good to be with you guys.
Wayne Moyer is with us, joining us by phone from Grinnell, the Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Wayne, welcome to you.
Hi, Ben.
You both have a long view on politics, political history here, and we're going to tap into that as well as your academic expertise here. We want to tap into our listening audience as well and ask you to join us with your questions as we examine this president in historical context. I just noticed I typed into a Google search the question, how long has Donald Trump been president? And there is actually a site that is dedicated to this, which is howlonghasdonaldtrumpbeenpresident.com. And as of this moment, 2 years, 149 days, 0 hours, 21 minutes, and 14, 15, 16 seconds, as I could go on all day. So we want to pick this juncture to see if we can get any sort of historical grasp on this president who is has proven his ability to sort of smash all political and policy norms and see what we come up with. Join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Before we get into this all-consuming topic of Trump, Tim Walch, let me ask you, how do we traditionally evaluate presidents?
Well, we can go in two different directions. We can use the kind of value system that an individual might have, in which you say, you know, how self-confident was that individual president? How much of a vision did they have? Did they have a legislative agenda? Could they work well with others in terms of building coalitions and collaborations? Those are qualities we often saw in presidents like Franklin D. Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson and so forth. Or you could use something of a metric. And one of the things I know that President Trump has done is said, well, how many executive orders has he signed compared to other presidents? Or how many judges has he appointed compared to other presidents? So there's any number of tools or measures we could use measuring individual presidents against each other. I'd like to say from the top, though, it's generally unfair. The circumstances faced by any individual president, combined with their personality and their skill set, will make it very difficult to have any kind of scientific control to measure quality in terms of their time in office.
Mm-hmm. Wayne Moyer, what sorts of things do you look to when you look to compare presidents?
Well, to what extent the president is simply following his predecessors, just continuing an agenda which was set before, or to what extent the president goes off on a new agenda and sort of transforms the political process or changes the political process.
Mm-hmm. And that's very interesting. We can bring that into modern times. George H.W. Bush, very much continuing, would you say, Ronald Reagan's vision?
Exactly. And what you see... Go ahead.
Yeah, Wayne. Very much. I guess the question is do you still see Trump as part of Ronald Reagan, or is Trump now going off on a new agenda, different from Ronald Reagan? There's some elements that are similar to Reagan's in terms of tax cuts. Reagan also had to deal with immigration issues. Reagan, on the other hand, was more on free trade. Trump clearly is for trade restrictions. and limiting free trade.
Mm-hmm. When we look at presidents and their parties, we have, in the last few decades at least, thought of what of the traditional policies of a Democratic president versus a Republican president. Ronald Reagan, you would think that any Republican president would, after Ronald Reagan, would pick up with more or less his policies. Is that what you think, Tim?
Yeah, I would say that clearly presidents who followed Ronald Reagan wanted to embrace that mantle. They see him as a, quote, great or near great president. So the aura, the legacy that came from the Reagan presidency kind of began to glow, even though as we lived through it, it perhaps wasn't quite as great as people seem to remember it in retrospect. But it's also true that Donald Trump has made his presidency more personal and more a measure of how much support you give to Donald Trump as an individual, as opposed to following a platform of values that reflect the traditional Republican Party. Because many of the views and values that Donald Trump expresses are not typically Republican. So it's more of a personality-driven presidency. Even though Ronald Reagan had a strong personality, he still was a conservative Republican and reflected conservative Republican values that his Congress reflected. I think many of the members of Congress who are Republicans are mystified. And one can see in Senator Grassley and Senator Ernst and Senator Graham and others being perplexed over things that they have to defend that they don't see as traditionally Republican.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation as we try to put President Trump in historical context on this day when he is officially kicking off his 2020 reelection campaign. 1-866-780-9100. We could put it this way. Join us with your thoughts on what quality a previous president has that you think is most needed today. 1-866-780-9100. Let's pick up on a hallmark of this president and try to trace communication. This president, and try to get your thoughts as we go back through previous presidents and how their communication reflects their time, and perhaps get a different perspective on this president. Wayne Moyer, how do you look back at previous presidents and the way they communicated effectively?
Well, different presidents in different ways. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt has his fireside chats. Other presidents have had frequent press conferences. Usually, presidents don't communicate day-to-day things directly to the press, but usually through White House staff members. What I think is different about Trump is the use of Twitter and things coming directly from the president on a day-to-day basis to the public, and with very, very broad announcements, important announcements coming directly from the president, sometimes without even it being clear that they've been worked through the staff.
Mm. Yeah, he's absolutely right. There's no filter on Donald Trump. Whatever he gets up in the morning and is bothering him or he's seen on Fox, he's going to send it out on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And so it's quite raw. And those are all, by the way, public records. Those are statements of the president of the United States. So
is this a historical milestone that we have a president in direct connection with 60 or 70 million Twitter followers that he has without the press being an intermediary for a substantial percent of the population?
His point of view is there's so much fake news out there that if, in effect, his White House press office were to give information to the fake media or whatever, that his story doesn't get out. And that's why he values Twitter. He believes he reaches those 70 or 80 million people. He also drives the whole news cycle because the regular press then follows along and reinterprets it, and it fills the space.
Tim Walsh is with us, presidential historian. Wayne Moyer, political scientist. We know from Politics Wednesday, it happens to be a Tuesday, we're looking at this president in a historical perspective. James is with us in Des Moines. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. James, thanks for joining our conversation. What's on your mind?
Well, first off, I would take him to task for saying his press secretary releases news to the fake media. Trump calls it the fake media, and maybe some of his followers do, but I think the media is the media. He's right. The one who has the fake media with Fox News. But I like the comparison of Trump with Warren G. Harding. And when the populace found out what kind of a crook Warren G. Harding was, they threw the rascal out. And I'm waiting for that to happen now, that the populace finds out what a crook he is and what he's done to our country. The fact that people just came back from Europe a month ago, the people there think he's crazy. They're afraid of him. And I was told once before, don't you know when America sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold?
James.
And he sneezed and sneezed and sneezed.
All right, James in Des Moines, you've given us a good historical point to hone in on. In the 1920s, we had a president, Warren G. Harding, Tim Walsh. Tell us about this scandal that James in Des Moines mentioned.
Well, of course, they used to say when Harding was asked during a time, it was a short presidency, of course, he died in office. But during his short presidency, he was asked about all of his critics and his enemies. And he said, you know, it's not my enemies I have to worry about, it's my damn friends. And in fact, the so-called K Street Gang, his infamous group of cronies, were mismanaging office, including the famous Teapot Dome oil reserve out in Wyoming, and of course Congress called him to task. Harding, I suppose, a certain measure of mercy. Harding died before the worst of the scandal was exposed by Congress, and so Coolidge was left to clean it up. Harding was one of those people who had been a senator and perfectly fine being a senator. They used to say he looked the part of a president. He was also the president who created the word normalcy. Because it should be normality, but Harding would call it normalcy, and my goodness, we've adopted that as a conventional word. So that's a contribution from Warren Harding. Not too much else. He tends to rank, if we rank presidents 1 through 45, he tends to be in that lower quarter.
A footnote to what James said also about fake news. I could see the quotations around fake news in your voice when I looked at you, Tim Walsh, and we have to distinguish between there are a couple, at least two different definitions of fake news running out there. One is news that is inaccurate, but Donald Trump doesn't use fake news in that sense.
No, he believes that if a story doesn't agree with the narrative that he thinks in his mind is true, that it's fake. That's why he uses Twitter, because he knows that his thumbs will tell the story he wants to have told, and that he gets terribly frustrated. I mean, lately he's released a tweet where he wanted to end the New York Times and the Washington Post, close them down. You know, it's that he does not like the stories, of course, that get out and accuses him of treason.
Okay, let's go back. Of course, we've danced around it here with the teapot scandal, but of course, central to this president and connecting him with other presidents in the past is investigations and purported scandal. Let's go back to a scandal, an investigation that both Wayne Moyer and Tim Walsh have in their living memory. We'll go back and listen to John Dean from 1973 and then tap Wayne and Tim for their personal memories of that time and draw comparisons, similarities and dissimilarities to what we're experiencing today. Here's a clip from John Dean, May 23rd, 1973. He's testifying before the Senate's Watergate Committee on his knowledge of the president's application or misapplication of his Nixon's powers in the Watergate cover-up. Dean served as an attorney on President Nixon's White House counsel from 1970 to 1973. Here's John Dean from 73.
What I had hoped to do in this conversation was to have the president tell me we had to end the matter now. Accordingly, I gave considerable thought to how I would present this situation to the president and try to make as dramatic a presentation as I could to tell him how serious I thought the situation was that the cover-up continue. I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it. I also told him that it was important that this cancer be removed immediately because it was growing more deadly every day.
The central question at this point is simply put, what did the president know? And when did he know it?
Okay, two of the iconic quotes there from the Watergate hearings. What did the president know and when did he know it? Howard Baker, then Senator Howard Baker, before that John Dean, the famous quote of cancer on the presidency. Wayne Moyer, do you happen to remember that testimony from John Dean?
Oh, yeah, that riveted the attention of just about everybody. And I can remember sort of watching on a day-to-day basis as the congressional hearings then followed. And this was at the top of everybody's attention for months.
Mm-hmm. Watergate, of course, brought up again and again in discussing President Trump. Democrats saying it's an apt comparison. Many Republicans deny any parallel. Wayne Moyer, pick it apart for us in this comparison with Watergate in the present day.
Well, there are some similarities. The sort of drip of information coming out, implicating the president in one way or another, I think is the primary similarity. There's some big differences, I think. However, one is that the Democrats controlled both houses of Congress at that stage of the game, which made impeachment an easier process, or at least conviction or possible conviction for appeasement more possible. The other thing that was cleared, a big difference, is from the very beginning, the implication was that Nixon himself was directly involved. We suspected, or many suspected, that Trump was directly involved with the Russians in the election campaign, although the Mueller report did not confirm that that was the case. Something else I think that is different, Nixon fired his prosecutor, or fired Archibald Cox, who was investigating the case. Trump did not fire Mueller. And I wonder, had Trump fired Mueller, whether impeachment would have gone ahead faster. So I think there are some differences as well as some similarities.
Tim Walz, your thoughts?
Oh, I think, frankly, I don't think Richard Nixon would have been impeached had it not been for the taping system. I think the very fact that those tapes and the fight over the tapes led to the members of Congress and eventually the public seeing transcripts of what the president actually said, so that when John Dean testified, that was his view, his recollection, and an amazing recollection. But then it was confirmed by the tapes for those days. And so they had this recording system. The interesting story about the recording system was they felt that Lyndon Johnson had a manually operated taping system in the White House to record conversations as he chose to do it. But they felt that President Nixon would be too clumsy in turning on the system, and people would compromise what they were saying if they knew they were being taped. Mm. So it was a voice-activated system from six different or seven different locations in the Oval Office. And I think they just forgot that they had that system. Why Richard Nixon didn't destroy those tapes. Now, again, that would have been controversial without question. But he kept the tapes, and of course the tapes would then verify everything that John Dean said. And I recall, as much as John Dean, I recall Alexander Butterfield's testimony saying, yes, there is a taping system. And, you know, there was a hush within that hearing room when they realized this well could be the end.
Interesting. Our current president, commenting on that time, of course, he's asked about it, has been asked about it numerous times by reporters over the months of his presidency. Here's a clip from President Trump, June 11th of this year, outside the White House. He was asked by a reporter some of his allies believe that if the Democrats open an impeachment inquiry, that it would help his reelection campaign. Here's his response.
You can't impeach somebody when there's never been anything done wrong. We have a no collusion. We have no anything. There's no obstruction. There's no collusion. There's no anything. When you look at past impeachments, whether it was President Clinton or I guess President Nixon never got there. He left. I don't leave. There's a big difference. I don't leave. We did nothing wrong except create the greatest economy in the history of our country. We did nothing wrong except rebuild our military like nobody's ever seen before. We're doing a great job. Our country has never been stronger.
I don't leave. Wayne Moyer, there's the Donald Trump saying a key difference between now and then, his actions here.
I think one thing that's very important is we went through a Clinton impeachment process, which actually strengthened Clinton in office. And I think that makes the Democrats rather hesitant to go ahead with impeaching Trump for fear that that might actually increase his popularity, as the Clinton impeachment actually increased Clinton's popularity.
Well, let's go back to that time, 1998. Here's a clip from September of 98, when Bill Clinton appeared before a grand jury for a second time. He was asked to clarify his previous testimony on his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, a former intern. He insisted that Lewinsky could deny a sexual relationship under oath and still be telling the truth.
It depends upon what the meaning of the word is.
Yes.
If is means is and never has been, that is not. That's one thing. If it means there is none, that was a completely true statement.
Okay, that quote, Tim Walz, certainly one that stands out for us. Bill Clinton, unlike Nixon, Nixon, as President Trump pointed out, left before an impeachment process could get started. Bill Clinton was impeached by the House, not convicted by the Senate.
That's right. It's a very high bar to be convicted. And of course, as for President Trump and impeachment, I think critics are right. That is, you can go through the process of having an impeachment, a bill of impeachment from the House of Representatives. And it's a political document, essentially. It would be Democrats saying, here are charges we bring against the President of the United States. It would go to the Senate, where I believe you need three quarters of the Senate or a high bar. At least a majority, more than a simple majority, and you have a Republican Senate, and you no longer have that cooperative spirit that once existed between the two houses. So it would go nowhere, and quite likely, President Trump would use his trial as a stage. And of course, one of the complaints that I know the Democrats, or the frustrations the Democrats have now, those in the House, they want to push forward their current agenda of lower health care costs and other reforms, infrastructure and so forth. But if impeachment talk is dominating the news cycle and the president keeps poking at it, it's going to be very difficult for people to see much of what the Democrats are saying they want to accomplish in the 2 years from 2018 to 2020.
We'll be back in just a moment. Tim Walz with us, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library. Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Cornell College. We're talking about presidents in historical context, as President Trump will tonight kick off his 2020 reelection campaign. Give us your thoughts about qualities of previous presidents you think are needed today, or other questions as we examine this president in historical context now that he's been in office for 2 years, 149 days and counting. Tim Walz with us, Wayne Moyer as well. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
Glad to have you on board on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. President Trump officially kicking off his 2020 presidential campaign with a rally tonight in Florida. Of course, he's been, it seems, and in fact, he has been running for a second term ever since he took office on inauguration, declaring his intent to run for a second term. This hour, we have a long views from Tim Walz, presidential historian, Wayne Moyer, political science professor of Grinnell College, giving us a historical perspective of where this president fits in. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Tim Walz, in the break, as we kind of re-geared to get into evaluating this president compared to others, the question that came up in your mind, should we be comparing presidents? Is it a fair thing to do, even though they're, of course, all in this category of U.S. presidents? you could make an argument that it's really not useful or what?
Exactly. I mean, it's a great parlor game. I mean, a lot of fun to determine, well, who's the greatest of our presidents and who are less so, who are the failures. And periodically, historians and political scientists will vote, and they'll use different criteria. They'll, you know, use questions of personal values. They'll use foreign policy. They'll use legislation. They'll use any number of measures. But it's still very subjective. And so in some ways, all of us, even academics, will be affected by our admiration or distaste for particular individuals. As far as President Trump's own self-image, when he came into office, you may recall that he had a portrait of Andrew Jackson placed in the Oval Office and kind of fancied himself a modern mm-hmm. Andrew Jackson, a disruptor president who accumulated executive power. Of late, he talks more about Abraham Lincoln and how mistreated Abraham Lincoln was. I should let you know that almost all presidents, to some extent, have compared themselves to Lincoln at one time or another or tried to embrace Lincoln and Lincoln's value. So that's not untypical. And Lincoln often is thought of as our greatest president. What's interesting to me is that you tend to hear of President Trump talking about other Republican presidents, so Lincoln and certainly Ronald Reagan, but you don't tend to hear him talking about presidents like Franklin D. Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson, who, of course, accumulated an extraordinary legacy of legislative accomplishment by working with the Congress, which is something that President Trump has struggled to do. Should we do it? It's very difficult. And I think this president has proven how difficult, because if you say, well, what president is Donald Trump most like? I couldn't tell you. I mean, there's a new book out that compares Donald Trump with Jimmy Carter and Herbert Hoover as disjunctive, disruptive presidents at the end of a long regime. And quite frankly, I can't think of three people more unlike each other than Jimmy Carter, Herbert Hoover, and Donald Trump. So,
mm-hmm. do you see it in those terms, Wayne Moyer? Which president is this president most like, or? Or do you think that's not a good question to ask?
I agree that there are problems in comparing presidents. You can compare certain things though. For instance, the amount of turnover within the administration, the amount of learning that takes place over time in the presidency, whether the president manages to build his coalition over time, how well the president is able to work with Congress. So there are a bunch of things that you can look at that are helpful, but I think it's going too far in terms of making comparative judgments between particular individuals.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned there's something, Wayne, let's go into a little bit more, the team of the president. Now, the leaders have different philosophies in the people that they surround themselves with. This president certainly has a very clear philosophy. At the beginning, he wanted people on his team, and as his more than 2 years have progressed, Wayne, he has let go people who do not see what 100% eye to eye, even have a slight variance with what the president's opinion is.
I think that's a major problem, because to what extent can any president really carry out consistent policies if he's changing his people all of the time? And we also have some evidence that people in the trenches are not doing exactly what the president wants. Part of the problem there is if the individuals at the top are changing all the time, they don't have the ability to communicate effectively what the president's messages are to if they've just come into their positions to people that are actually trying to carry out the messages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Wayne's absolutely right. And in fact, there's a higher degree of cabinet officers and staff members who have prefix acting in front of their name, because the president likes the fact that they don't have the job permanently. And if he doesn't want to either send their name to Congress or doesn't want to keep them, he can remove them at a moment's notice. Well, that means that whoever is the acting, say, Secretary of Defense really doesn't have the cachet or the authority to go forward and carry out policies. And as you suggest, it's clear that if that cabinet officer disagrees with or has a recommendation to make to the president doesn't like it, as in the case of Kirstjen Nielsen, out they go. Mm-hmm. And so the truth of it is, it's very difficult to run the government if you don't have the give and take, the collegiality. That was one thing that Harry Truman embraced. He loved the fact that he could bring in people like Dean Acheson, and they could discuss, and he could learn from his cabinet. That's a level of confidence, as well as a level of humility, that allows a president to say, you know, I don't know everything. I'm not the smartest guy in the room. There are others who know as much or more as me, and I want to learn from them.
Mm-hmm. Wayne, I want you to touch on one area that we should not leave out: foreign policy. How does President Trump compare with previous presidents, I guess, perhaps in this century or the 20th century? He is a departure of a great magnitude from presidents, be they Republican or Democrat, isn't he?
He's certainly a departure from any president since Franklin Roosevelt. Certainly in terms of moving toward liberal trade and reducing trade restrictions. He's gone back to a previous period of higher trade restrictions. The other big difference, particularly since the end of the Second World War, is a criticism of our alliances. The U.S. built a system of allies around the world, a political order comparable to the economic order that was built after the free trade economic order that was built after the Second World War. Trump has paid much less attention to alliances, certainly with regard to NATO, consistently saying that the allies need to pay more. He is not a believer in multilateralism, but more unilateralism, the U.S. acting individually, dealing with other nations, than rather than working through international organizations or with other countries to deal with collective issues such as climate change, for instance. That's a big difference from any post-World War II president.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to an earlier comment. Tim, you mentioned that President Trump likes to mention President Lincoln, or 16th president. Let's get a little taste of President Trump at a rally in Florida almost a year ago in 2018 in August. President Trump speaking about where he stands amongst the greatest presidents of all time, including where he stacks up against Abraham Lincoln.
I can be more presidential than any president in history, except for possibly Abe Lincoln with a big hat. I don't know if I can. Abe looked pretty presidential, right? What do you think? He's tough. He's tough. I admit it, Abe Lincoln is tough. But we love Abe Lincoln.
Okay, there. I think this president has admitted, you can correct me if not, Tim Walz, he has never read a presidential biography.
No, he's
but
not
has
a,
but has a fascination of a certain sort with the past presidents.
Well, I think there's no question that, that most people, as they go through school, are asked who their favorite president is. And, of course, they know about President's Day and all the rest of that. And, of course, I think it's generally accorded the fact that the big three, so to speak, are George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin D. Roosevelt in terms of our, quote, greatest presidents. Donald Trump, I think, has inserted himself into that quartet, perhaps pushing Washington and FDR out of the way and inserting himself as number two behind, as he says, President Lincoln with the tall hat.
Right.
Right. I don't know that the hat makes much difference, but the president does take great care with the top of his head.
We were talking about team building.
Yes.
President
team of rivals.
President Lincoln did not believe in the same sort of team that President Trump does.
No. I mean, the people he brought into his cabinet were not only people who disagreed with him in many cases, they were people who thought they were all much smarter than he was. But he had the self-confidence and, again, the humility to listen to what they had to say and eventually brought them together into a unified whole. And of course, it's very different than a situation that we currently have where you recall those cabinet meetings where the press was allowed in and each member of President Trump's cabinet would say how much they appreciate being appointed and so on and so forth. And it was embarrassing. It was uncomfortable. I can't imagine Abraham Lincoln ever allowing anything that to happen.
Wayne Moyer, comment on this. Earlier, we learned that you were a young man when John Dean gave his his testimony before the Senate's Watergate committee, starting your political career as a political science professor and analyst here. I'm wondering if you could comment on the extent to which we can view a president as a reaction to the president who came before, so that we can see perhaps in the later part of the 20th century into the 21st century, in what ways, for instance, did Carter usher in Reagan? Did Bush 41 usher in Clinton? How did Bush 43 open the door for Obama, and how Obama led to Trump? What are your thoughts there, Wayne?
Well, certainly there is an element of reacting to your predecessor. But I think probably more important is reacting to the conditions that you actually happen to be facing or that your predecessor was facing. Watergate comes at the end of the Vietnam War era. We had been highly energized by the war and the sense that we had not been told the truth by the Johnson administration and then later by the Nixon administration in terms of what was actually going on. So in some ways, we were primed for a Watergate type of situation. The situation now is so vastly different than what it was in 1972, 1973, that it's hard to say it's just a reaction to your predecessor or your predecessor's policies.
So one factor among many.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tim, you wanted to jump in?
Well, I just wanted to say, some of us, and I'm sure Wayne recalls this too, is that when Jimmy Carter was running for president, he said, "I will not lie to you," which of course was a reflection on what Richard Nixon had done. He had lied to us, and we were terribly disappointed. What we found lacking in Jimmy Carter was the charisma and the vision that we wanted, and when offered the opportunity to bring Ronald Reagan, who had such sense of confidence and vision going forward, and had that message that people embraced. We periodically look for a president who's going to deliver on their promises, but very often we find that we're disappointed in the promises and the failure of that president to deliver, which always makes it a challenge for a president running for that second term. Did they deliver?
Right.
Ed Koch used to say, running for New York, how am I doing? How am I doing?
Well, in that sense, this president was elected. He campaigned on being a disruptor, which he has delivered in spades.
But he also claimed he was going to drain the swamp. The swamp's getting close to our noses, I think, at this point.
One thing that most people, I'm sure historians, political analysts, or people who are paying attention to our politics these days, I think we can say safely, all agree that we are experiencing some sort of significant historical change during the term of this president. I wonder what your thoughts are about what we can say for sure about the nature of this change. And you know where I'm going. I know historians hate to extend things out in the future, but what are we experiencing? Wayne, do you have a sense of that?
Well, I think there are several things. One, America's relative power in the world is declining. China is rising rapidly, and that's going to create all sorts of challenges. We have global challenges such as climate change, which have to be dealt with. Will the Trump strategy work in terms of dealing with global issues? The immigration problem isn't going to go away. It's linked to the climate change issue, among other issues. The China issue isn't going to go away. We also have new technologies now, cyber warfare, et cetera. Shifting economic scene, a shifting international political scene, great challenges. It's not quite clear that we'll be able to deal with them with present policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'd like to add something about, of course, the social conflict. Some folks will remember the great cartoonist Walt Kelly, who did a strip called Pogo. And during the Vietnam War, there was a famous panel that said, "We've met the enemy and they are us." Well, I think you could say in our current era, we have met the president and he is us. I mean, that is that what we hear from President Trump is a lot of the conflict and acrimony and bitterness that seems to be going on, certainly on cable television. It may be going on in other communities or in town halls. There just seems to be a level of friction that has taken over our social relationships. Now, whether that's a breakdown in the number of civic organizations or other attendance at an organized religion or whatever. Nevertheless, there is a level of social conflict. We see every day, it seems, gun violence and that sort of thing. So the president may well be a reflection of what's going on with the general populace.
Mm-hmm. As we end up this conversation, thoughts on the future. The New York Times, I think, had a headline today or yesterday, "Is Trump a fluke or the future?" Wayne, what do you think? Is this president an anomaly, or does he presage a new era of politics?
We won't know for sure, I think, until after the election. My own inclination is to look at him as an anomaly, although he has changed the political discourse. He has crudened, I guess you would say, or made cruder the political discourse, and it seems to be working. So I think there are some changes there. But I think about future presidents will not only have to work about bringing out their own base, but broadening their political base as their presidency expands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would say, you know, Wayne's right. And of course, Donald Trump is sort of a paradigm shift. It's very hard to look back on previous presidents and see how there was a direct connection, say, between Obama and Trump, or even Ronald Reagan and Trump. So that what you see is a total shift. And of course, it's only been 5 years or 4 years since he came down that escalator in New York and announced his presidency, and people thought, oh, goodness, that's not going anywhere. Well, goodness, here it is. And when we're talking about whether or not, as the New York Times suggests, is this the future? Well, I can't see any Republican candidates with that kind of style or charisma or ability, bombast, whatever you want to call, and crudity that would carry us forward. But who knows, might come down the escalator and all of a sudden take things over. So I think what it's brought to political prognostication is a measure of instability. We find it very difficult to project what's going to happen going forward.
And our new media environment will continue to change very quickly. Donald Trump has capitalized on social media, on Twitter, especially. So we know whether Donald Trump is president after 2020 or another president. They will be using the social media. And Wayne, it's unlikely that a future president would not want to have direct communication with the electorate, right?
No, I'm certain that they will, and probably use Twitter. But then what will follow Twitter, and how will presidents communicate? We won't know the details until things actually change.
Mm. Final thoughts before we end this hour, Tim Walsh, something that didn't get mentioned that you'd like to
leave us? Well, let's end on a positive note, okay. And that is all of the acrimony and the discussion and even all the chatter that goes on cable and the outrageous things the president said has encouraged people to learn and explore the history of the presidency. The very fact that we're doing this program now on the eve of his re-announcement is a good indication that people are being encouraged to get involved in knowing more about their government and its history.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to leave us with a bright point, Wayne, as well?
I agree. I think we've actually been activated politically by the current president, even if some of us are outraged by what he's doing. But I suspect that we will have a higher turnout in the 2020 election than we had in the 2016.
Tim Walsh, is it too early to tell how President Trump will be remembered in history? How do we know when too early is not too early?
Let me say this. I'm looking forward to living long enough to see the Trump Presidential Library whenever it comes, because I think it's going to be an extraordinary spectacle. It'll be very different from any of the other presidential libraries.
Okay, we know that there's still...
Probably in Mar-a-Lago.
Okay, Chicago, the site of President
Obama's...
The Obama
Presidential Center, you bet.
So, and you are the past director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential
Library? Very small by comparison. The first four are very modest by comparison. They grow almost like theme parks. So it'll be a very interesting evaluating the Trump presidency, which will start with his presidential library and his papers and all those tweets. The sheer volume, the terabytes of information will be far more than any scholar will be able to master.
All right. We'll
the
look.
The biggest presidential library ever.
Yes. And the best, Wayne, the best.
Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Tim Walch, Director Emeritus of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch. We thank you very much for sharing your thoughts at this time. Wayne and Tim, we appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Ben.
Tomorrow on this program, of course, is Politics Wednesday. Dave Anderson of Iowa State University will be joining us, as well as Evan Renfro will be talking about Iran, also Egypt, and many other items. So we hope you'll join our conversation tomorrow for Politics Wednesday. River to River is available as a podcast. Just subscribe to River to River using your favorite podcast app. You can also hear past shows by going to iowapublicradio.org, or you can download our IPR app. There's so many ways not to miss River to River or our other programs, or to share a discussion with others. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.